Welcome to Ask a Doctor, what your doctor wants you to know with Dr. Virgie. Over the next hour, you'll learn valuable medical tips from health policy to personal finance and medical debt management. Now listen close and welcome your host, Dr. Virgie Bright Ellington.
On today's segment of What Your Medical Debt Doctor Wants You to Know, we're very fortunate to be joined by Dr. Carrie Forrestal. Dr. Forrestal is the author of Crushing Cancer, a patient's complete guide to managing a cancer diagnosis, in which he devotes an entire chapter to managing the financial impact of cancer. So Dr. Forrestal, I know I've asked you this before. You're an emergency medicine physician, and you wrote what people are calling the most helpful, comprehensive, and honest how-to when it comes to not just managing a cancer diagnosis, but crushing cancer and coming out living your best life. Tell me again, what made an ER doc decide to write the complete guide to dealing with a cancer diagnosis?
Well, first, thank you so much for having me. It's always a pleasure talking with you. It's always a blast. So thanks so much for having me. So there's three answers. I'll give you the shorthand version as much as an Irishman can. So the first is that in the emergency department, we find a lot of things that are suspicious for cancer. We can never say that we diagnose cancer in the ER because that's a pathology diagnosis. You got to put it under a microscope. So we find a lot of things, though. Somebody comes in with a cough. We scan the chest looking for blood clots or, you know, taking an x-ray for a pneumothorax. And, oh, there's this lung cancer or something that looks like a lung mass. And we do that, most of us, probably on a weekly basis. You know, somebody comes in for one complaint and then goes home with this life-changing issue. It's always been very frustrating to me that I can only say, yeah, you got a problem. Good luck with that. So, you know, my thing was I want to do something that does more beyond the walls of the emergency department. So that was one of the things. The second is that when you something goes wrong, where do you go? So in cancer care, you know, if you get that neutropenic fever where you have a fever, you know, 7 to 10 days after you've done your chemotherapy, and there's this worry about overwhelming sepsis or an infection, you're coming to the ER. Now, a lot of times delays or frank misses can be avoided if people have better information. So that's the second thing. And even, you know, this goes back to even finance. You know, we talk about the financial part of things. You say, well, how do you tie that all together? If you can't afford your medications,
yes,
things are going to happen. And you wind up again on my doorstep. And if you can better manage finances or work or all those things, if you can manage them better, you may avoid coming to visit me. I'm always happy to see you. I don't know that I'm always, it's the same experience on the patient side. I don't think they're happy to see me.
Sure.
You know,
sure.
So I want to help people. And then the third, you know, cancer runs very, very strongly in my family. You know, my mom's working on her third bout of lung cancer. So we think she's clear now. First one was a lobectomy. Second and third were radiation. Dad's had skin cancer. My brother-in-law has had prostate cancer. My grandfather died of bladder cancer, metastatic to the colon, or rather to the liver. My grandmother had uterine cancer in the days when there's treatment. Are you ready for this? Pack the uterus with radium pellets.
Whoa.
Right. And
I thought you were going to talk about that. That really predates stuff. I thought you were going to talk about, refer to what they called TPE, total pelvic exoneration, where they take out everything, every bladder, intestines, and you just come out with just a hole for a drain with that your stool and your urine comes out and that's it.
Yeah, one of our
that's
friends.
That's really going back. I hadn't heard about that one. Wow.
Yeah, well, they recommended that to one of our friends a few years back who had recurrent ovarian cancer. Mm-hmm. And they said, you know, this is what we're going to need to do. And she drew the line. She said, I'm not living like that.
That's right.
You know, and that's a personal choice. That's not wrong or right. For her, she was not doing it. Yeah. And that goes into another part of the book. When she was making that decision, she goes, I'm not doing that. But I heard of a guy in Mexico who's got a clinic. And we'll have to take out a mortgage. We'll have to take out a partial remortgage of the house to get down there. What do you think? You know, and it was heartbreaking because I had to tell her, it's just going to flush money down the drain. I mean, you know, and you're taking away that little sliver of hope and it just kills you. So, but those are the three reasons. It runs strongly in the family. We find a lot of it and I want to be able to do more about it, you know, both you know, helping people when they leave the ER and stopping them from coming in.
Yes.
You know, or not stopping, that's not the right phrase, but avoiding the need for them to come in.
That's preventable.
Yeah.
And not having resources to pay for your medicines, I would put that in the preventable category. Dr. Forrestal, I agree with you. So what would you say then are the most important points in managing the financial impact of cancer?
So I think when I've had this question, it's such a great question. And this is, you and I are getting that word out. You know, your work is fantastic with this. And, you know, if they take your money, how do you have more to continue to fight? Right. So making sure the work that you do, you know, like I said, it's critically important for that. So the first thing I tell people, though, is start from hour one, day one of the diagnosis, working on your financial plan. Now, that's hard to do, you know, when you're thinking about, oh, my God, this has happened. My whole life is, you know, it changes the framework of your life. But as soon as you can, you need to get to work. You need to have those conversations. The example I use is, for example, of the, you know, your rent or your electric bill or whatever. The conversation you can have at the beginning of treatment, when you've just found out it's brand new and you have to go to your landlord and say, you know, I'm a little jammed up here. You know, it's I can pay my bills, but, you know, as I go along, I don't know how long this is going to go. I may need some consideration. You know, I've been a good tenant. You know, I may have a little problem. I'll get the bill paid eventually, but I may have a problem in about 6 to 9 months. Mm. Keep up is a different conversation than if you are 3 months behind. Mm. Where's my money? You say, well, I've been sick. Mm-hmm. You know, it's a very, very different vibe.
Good
you know,
point.
You can talk to your electric company, you can talk to your utility companies and say, hey, look, could you put a flag on my chart? You know, what programs do you have that can help me out? Can you do balanced billing? You know, well, that's a bad word for medical people, but
yeah.
Electricity.
That's a four-letter word for me.
That's absolutely.
For medical debt doctors.
Go back and erase that part. But the idea that maybe you can work on a payment plan.
Yes.
And the other thing I like to tell people, and this is the best thing that I've found that nobody knows about, is the 2-1-1 system. Right.
So I've never heard of that. What's the 2-1-1 system?
This is a fantastic project. I don't know who came up with this, but they need some sort of medal of something. So the 2-1-1, anywhere in the United States, if you dial 2-1-1, you will be connected to a service center that will help you with resources. They will ask you your zip code and you say, okay, I'm at, you know, what was the Beverly Hills one? 90210. All right. So I'm at 90210. And you say, well, what's your need? And I did this. I actually called them. I said, okay, let's say I was a guy who had a medical problem and I needed help with my electric bill. Who could help me? And they do their little typey type thing. And they go, okay, so there's these four places. These guys can help you with the electric bill. You can call this, 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 and this. You can call the Salvation Army if you call them early in the month, because the money goes quick. And working in the ER, I know the resources that he was given located to my zip code were correct.
Wow.
And I said, well, what if I was a veteran? He goes, okay, then you got this, this, and this. You know, so the 2-1-1 system is a way of plugging in where you are to the resources that are in your community to help you out.
Oh my God.
So that's something to, you know, to get in on early on. You know, if I keep proselytizing like this, I'm sure they're going to need to add extra staff, because I tell everybody about this system. It is just brilliant. It really
is. That is gold. I mean, that's platinum. Oh my gosh. Outstanding. I had no idea. I'd never heard of it before.
Yeah.
This is huge.
Yeah. Try it. Like, go just give them your thing. Say, look, I'm a doctor doing research on medical, and just, you know, you know, your resources in your community, and just say, if I needed to, you know, pick one, if I need to pay my rent, if I need to pay my electric bill is the one that I used, and just see if what they're telling you is true, and it'll blow your mind. They're wonderful. Those guys.
Outstanding. So, thank you.
Two-on-one.
Oh my gosh. Oh my gosh.
That would be the first thing. That's number one. So then starting out, number two, I would say, you know, make the honest budget. Go into your, you know, whatever online or however you track your finances and look at what you're spending. That's a good idea anytime, you know, because we have these things that we subscribe to, you know, and then we forget about them and they just keep sapping down our money. And, you know, it's there's this explosion now of subscription services.
Yes.
You know, so you've got Hulu and Apple and Paramount and Joe's and Apple, you know, again, and, you know, so you get all these subscriptions, and are you really using them? you know, especially if you're going through something that's going to be such a financial strain, you know, that how much of this do you actually need? Now, I wouldn't, you know, Netflix has some wonderful stuff, and not to plug their product or anything like that. And it you will need some form of entertainment while you're going through all this. I'm not saying, you know, shut down everything. So just pick the ones that we really need. Look
but
at your,
you know, to your point, you know, even Taco Bell has a subscription service.
Really?
So you need to go through your statements, you know, your credit card bills, your debit card bills at the end of the month, and look at, you know, the how does it go? Death by a thousand cuts.
Yeah.
You know, it's the it's one of like the newsletters, online newsletters that you subscribe to, premium membership you subscribe to for $4.99 a month. You know, after a while, that does add up. That's a meal, you know, after a couple of months, you know, and, you know,
I'm still boggled by the fact
that Taco Bell is probably not going to be the right subscription meal plan to have.
Absolutely. I'm still boggled by the fact that Taco Bell has a subscription plan. I've never heard of that.
Yeah, what's really sad is that I know that. That's the sad part.
I'm not going to ask how.
Leave it there. Just don't ask more questions.
patient, let me know that one. Yeah, that's how that is. But yeah, no, that's exactly right. I mean, I think, you know, I try to keep up with the news, and I know I have the New York Times. I think I have the Washington Post, you know, so it's that sort of thing.
Exactly.
You know, and all of us benefit from going through and just scrubbing our finances. You know, it's like, whoa, I haven't opened that. And, you know, in 6 months, maybe that isn't a good use of my money.
Yep, exactly.
So go through and see where your resources are. And a really important thing is to remember, the money in your checking account is not your resources. Right? It is a resource and the last one you should tap. So, you know, you look at the other places where you have resources, be it, you know, your healthcare insurance is a resource, of course, and any of the resources that can pay the bills before you get to your money.
Mm.
Right. So, and look at that. So look at the inflows, look at the outflows. How can you tune this up? And again, that's good advice today. Anybody who doesn't have any problems whatsoever, go in and you'll just make your financial situation better. You know, and where can you get resources from? You know, we have a whole long thing. If you have a 401k and you need money, you can actually borrow, not take the money out of the account, but borrow it for an interest-free loan. And you can pay it back without any interest. If you end up not being able to pay it back, it doesn't go on your credit report. You know, you just have to pay a 10% penalty for having early withdrawal from your retirement account.
If you're under the age of 59 and a half.
Correct. Exactly right. So, you know, those sorts of things. So understand where your resources are and your outflows are. So that's the second big one. And I'm going to check out that Taco Bell thing.
Just don't tell them who told you.
We'll keep that between you, me, and the million people who listen to this podcast. So
I know my secret is safe with you, that, you know, there's no internal medicine physician that would ever give you that kind of information.
Absolutely. The DR guy absolutely would. We're terrible. So I guess the next thing I would say, you know, don't go it alone. You know, it's trying to figure all this out, you know, just like you wouldn't try to figure out what your chemo treatment should be, for example. Right? You'd ask experts and you would get good advice and then you would move forward with that. Don't try to figure all the financial stuff out alone. You know, if you can afford a financial advisor, that's a great thing. If you have one, you know, say, hey, look, you know, we're going to go into choppy waters here for a little bit. But the other resource that's fantastic are the nurse navigators. You know, we think about them just primarily for medical things, and that is their primary function, but they know the resources of the house. So, you know, they know where you can get these sorts of advice, the legal advices that you may need. You know, they have those resources. So they are definitely your Sherpa guides on this whole thing.
Dr. Forstall, tell me about nurse navigators.
So there's a specialty within oncology and in nursing. These are people who not only specialize in the care of cancer patients, but basically helping them navigate the journey. So this is these guys, I can't say enough good things about these guys. They helped me, you know, in constructing the book. What should be in here? What do your patients need? And they were so generous in giving their time. So yeah, well, our guys need this, 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 and this. A lot of the structure of the book came from just asking the right question. We had that conversation once before. Asking the right question get you places you need to be. So, and asking them, what do you need? This is what they came back with. So they are the experts in how to navigate everything, how to make sure your appointments are done, where to get your medicines at a good cost, where are the legal resources to help you if you need to, you know, do powers of attorney and those sorts of things. These are the guys who know the system in and out.
Wow. So every oncologist affiliated with every institution in the United States has a connection to nurse navigators.
As far as I know, okay. Yes.
Awesome.
I think the nurse navigator corps, I mean, it's a newer specialty. Okay. You know, oncology nursing, you know, the people who know how to take care of the wounds from cancer and the chemo and do all this stuff, they've been around since there's been anybody doing chemo, you know, since the 1940s, you know, when Stanley Farber did his thing, next day you had a nurse, you know, nurse oncologist, you know, who was doing that. So far as I know, all systems have nurse navigators, but I don't have that confirmed. I just assume, you know, it's a little bit like you got four walls and a roof. You got an oncologist, you got to have a nurse navigator.
Exactly. That's what it sounds like. And I have to tell you, I worked, fortunately, not extensively with an oncologist personally, but I never needed the resources that the nurse navigator could provide. So I didn't know nurse navigators existed. And I've been working with my oncologist for 7 years now. So this is really helpful information. This is huge. I did not know this. I didn't know they existed.
Yeah, they're fantastic. And they're so giving of their time. You know, if it can help a patient, they're there. So.
Excellent. Excellent. You're listening to Ask a Doctor. What Your Doctor Wants You to Know with Dr. Virgie on the Voice America Health and Wellness channel. We'll be back after this short break. I have some exciting news. I wrote a book, What Your Doctor Wants You to Know to Crush Medical Debt, comes out May 19th. But you can head over to Amazon or BarnesandNobles.com and pre-order a copy now. And a book launch wouldn't be complete without some parties, right? Join me next Friday on April 29th for a Crush Medical Debt book celebration happy hour, where I'm giving away Visa gift cards to help you pay for your debt, as well as making a big announcement. See you next Friday at crushmedicaldebt.com.
Your life, your health, your network. You're listening to Voice America Health and Wellness.
You're listening to Ask a Doctor, What Your Doctor Wants You to Know with Dr. Virgie. If you have a question for Dr. Virgie or her guests, you can email Dr. Virgie at dr.virgie@crushmedicaldebt.com. Now back to the show. Here again is Dr. Virgie.
Welcome back to the show. Thank you so much for joining us.
So I guess the other things, you know, when we talk about what to do, the bills will start coming in pretty quickly. And the medical decisions about, you know, let's say I want to put a patient on Zofran. Now, I'm not an internal medicine guy. My wrestling matches with insurance companies are practically non-existent. Mm-hmm. You know, it's emergency care, so they leave us a lot of latitude. Sure, but sure. We do come in with, you know, patients do come in because of problems, because of denied care. You know, they couldn't get the care, something goes off the rails, and here they are in the emergency department. So I looked into that whole process. Your work, was it 90% of bills are wrong?
Up to 90%, 80 to 90% of every bill that's generated in the United States has errors. And if you can imagine, they're not going to be in the to the benefit of the patient. They're going to be for the benefit of the provider and or the insurance company.
Yep, absolutely. And then the care decisions then also, when they decline these things, sometimes they're just seeing if you'll go for it.
Yes.
You know, they'll decline it. And it's like, well, if he repeals it, then let him go through it. And, you know, they make people who are in the roughest part of our lives of cancer care, they're making these people jump through hoops.
Exactly.
So,
least bandwidth to be able to deal with this. Exactly.
Yep. So the thing I tell people is when you have something that's, you know, let's say I need, you know, air to breathe, you know, not oxygen, I mean like air to breathe. And I say, you know, I'm not really feeling it. You know, that there's that internet meme that's going around. It blows your mind to say the doctor says you need it and the insurance company says, nah, maybe, right? Ask for the name of every person who touched that chart to make that decision. I want every single name of every single person who made that decision. And it tends to switch the thinking.
Yeah.
Now, it tends to, oh, okay, my name's on this now. Okay. You know, and it's a reasonable thing. You know, you have the right to know who's taking care of your medical care. I mean, that's one first thing you do when you go up to see a patient. What's the first thing? I'm Dr. Forstall. I'm an attending physician here. You know, that's the first thing you lead with is the name. And, you know, so you have the right to know who's taking care of you and who's making the medical decisions to take care of you.
Excellent.
So, yeah,
so
like,
the folks that are taking care, meaning the insurance company, the medical directors, the physicians and nurses who review your case, your medical care, you have the right to know who's taking care of your medical care if you have insurance.
Yeah. I wish we could get the people in the insurance world. I mean, I have a business degree and I know how it works, right? You make money, maximize shareholder return. I get that. And I was trained at Binghamton where they had a more corporate citizen philosophy, you know, where we are part of our community. And they tell the story, you know, Brian Perry and Polly Venable and all the guys up at their great George Babinski. They tell the story of Endicott Johnson's Shoes, who during the Depression should have let everybody go, but kept everybody on payroll. And, you know, Endicott Johnson was one of the best corporate citizens. They still exist. You know, that's a shoe that they've been around for 150 years, well, however much it is, but by being a part of their community. And I wish we could get to a point with the insurance companies where they understand they are taking care of our patient too. You're part of this. You know, they're not numbers and they're not, I understand you want to make money and that's grand. Good. You know, money's great. I like it. It's fun, you know, but you're in this too with us. You're at the bedside, even remotely. So if I could get that message to the insurers, that would be great.
So Dr. Forrestal, you know, here we go. I knew that we were going to get into some, you know, economic and political stuff. And just by having the conversation, eventually we talk about medical debt with the American patient. We talk about the United States medical care system, we're going to get into these issues. So, you know, I am not going to ask you what year you went to Binghamton, but yes, at one time, the requirement for corporations was to be, quote unquote, a good corporate citizen, meaning return some of your profits, revenues to the community. Okay. The problem is in the late 70s, a law was made, a federal law, SEC made a law such that any publicly traded corporation, their number one requirement is no longer being a good corporate citizen. It is now maximizing return of profits or returns to shareholders. So just to cut to the chase, every year, if you have a health insurance company that is publicly traded, which is most of the large health insurance companies in this country, they're publicly traded, by law, they have to maximize profits to their shareholders. So if they try to say, look, you know, this is actually for the best, you know, we're going to think about decreasing how much we increasing how much we return or pay providers for such care or other services, medical care. By law, actually, that's illegal for them to do that.
Right.
Sounds crazy, but the U.S. medical care system is run by private and publicly traded insurance companies. So this is why Yeah. So, we feel that, they don't care about the little guy. They're kind of constrained by federal law as a publicly traded institution, company.
Right. Is it not true that take corporation of your choice, right? This is, I always remember these shenanigans on the 10K, 10Q forms. So let's say we have name a corporation that any corporation like Joe Corp. Okay. Joe Corp can claim goodwill as a fungible tangent, as an asset.
You're absolutely right.
If you think about, I return to my community this, which increases the health of my community or the standing of my community or reduces the crime or reduces the drug rate. That goes into that line of goodwill. It could go into the line of public relations, right? So there is an accounting mechanism to say that is actually something that we can return, that's in our returns. That is something that goes to our bottom line.
Excellent point, Dr. Forrestal. There you go. Outstanding point.
Yeah, I had never thought of that before. So I didn't know about that SEC law. That blows my mind. It's
yeah. You also reminded me of the publicly traded, I'm sorry, I misspoke, public, quote unquote, public benefit corporations are now a thing. Instead of establishing a corporation, you can establish a public benefit corporation just for that reason to say, okay, yes, profits, we are a for-profit entity. However, public good is just as important as our mission as of obtaining net revenue profit. So that there's a mechanism in which you can be, I guess, publicly traded and be a public benefit corporation, but that's relatively recent. Yeah. And I don't know of any huge, huge mega corporations that are structured as a public benefit corporation. But to your point, I didn't know about that either, that actually goodwill is part of an accounting measure in corporations. And, that's on the 10K form.
Yeah.
That's an important point.
It's been 20 years since I was at my MBA, but in the days of the dinosaurs, I remember that saying, like, just having that name is worth money, and it blew my mind. But yeah, and like I said, so it's a matter of what we teach in our business schools.
Yes.
None of this stands alone. Everything is interconnected. So what we teach the young minds coming out of business programs, be they bachelor's or be they MBAs, they will absorb what we teach them. And again, I really consider myself fortunate to have gone through Binghamton, because they were really, it's like you are a member of your community, so go make all the money you can. That's great. But it was the 80s when I went through. So, what that whole scene was about. But be a corporate citizen. So I don't know if the SEC
were a corporate citizen. So if I remember correctly, I can't be held to this because I don't remember the exact year when I was reading about this and when I was told about it by this Wall Street guy. He says, it's actually, I think it was in 78, 79. So we talk about the 80s being the go-go, greed years of Wall Street. That's when the switch happened, at the late 70s, when the law was you had to be a corporation had to be a good corporate citizen. When the law changed to your primary responsibility is maximizing profits to your shareholders, that's when everything changed. So Binghamton in the 80s, they were still teaching, rightfully so, that it's important to be a good corporate citizen and you can document goodwill in the county. You can account for that. There's a cash number applied to that line item, right? And since then, other many, 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 many corporations have gone in the direction of saying, hey, by law, we have to make as much money as we can.
Yeah, but it's an out.
That's a problem when healthcare, taking care of human beings, is run by publicly traded insurance companies. Physicians are, we don't run, it's been decades since we've been in charge of the U.S. healthcare system.
Yeah, no, that's very true. Private equity buying up emergency practices has become a huge thing. And that we'll get way into the weeds. You need to get Mitch Lee on here if you want to talk about private equity taking over. He is the man leading the charge there. He's a brilliant guy, and he is waging war on private equity. So,
oh my gosh, tell me about Mitch Lee. I don't know Mitch Lee.
So Mitch Lee, he's an emergency medicine physician who has, I'll have to put you in contact with him. He is just really at the forefront of saying it's not the best of ideas to, what's the best way to say this? You can't serve two masters, we know, and it's not the best of ideas to have people whose sole purpose as a corporation is to return equity to their shareholders, you know, when you're dealing with healthcare.
Yes.
You know, and in emergency medicine, we have Envision and a few of the other guys. I'm in a small private group. There are, you know, we have four contracts and we're tiny. But some of these groups have hundreds of contracts, if not more, throughout the United States. And they're not, their product is doctors, mm-hmm. you know, providing care, and they want to do it on the cheap. They want to make it as not even cost effective. They just want to minimize the amount of expense. So if they can get a doctor who's spent 10, 12, you know, 14, however many years you want, you know, to work for, you know, $20 an hour, that's what they have to do. And that's what they're trying to do, is they're driving the wages down. They're bringing in, you know, there's some questionable behaviors about APPs. You know, the people kind of the mid-levels, you know, the way they're distributing them or putting them into practice.
Physician extenders.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And it's a whole world that, I can't even begin to scratch the surface of it. I mean, it would take us, you know, we were talking about, and if this gets edited out, that's fine. We were talking about what to produce for CVS. That would be the thing, is what private equity will probably wind up to be one of the biggest medical scandals of the, you know, early part of the century. But it is astonishing what's going on.
Well, it's interesting you talk about it as being a scandal. That is why the concept, the proliferation of private equity owning physician group practices, physician employers, is why the Surprise Billing Act made it through Congress at the end of 2020 and went into effect the beginning of this year, January 1, 2022, because the profit was made by these private equity. It cracks me up. You have to laugh so you don't cry. Their goal was to say, okay, we're going to hire physicians who provide care when you don't have any choice. Emergency room docs, emergency medicine physicians, anesthesiologists, trauma surgeons, pathologists who read your tissue diagnosis if you have a cancer to rule out cancer. We're going to hire all of those, and none of them are going to take insurance. They're not going to take any insurance. So when you get rolled in, God forbid you get, you know, in a car accident and you get rolled in, you get treated, you get home. If you have insurance, it doesn't matter. They're going to bill you their full retail rate.
Yeah.
Because they don't take insurance. And so that's what the Surprise Billing Act was created to do, to get at these private equity corporations, where the goal is to get at that cush between the retail. They can charge whatever the market bears. They can charge whatever they want because they can. And there's nothing you can do about it. And you have no control over who takes care of you. And if they take your insurance, if you happen to have insurance, if they take insurance or not, if you roll in unconscious from, you know, a car accident or something.
Yeah.
So yeah, that's why these private equity folks taking advantage of people at their most vulnerable and most helpless.
Yeah.
That's the American way. And there was the Surprise Billing Act directly to deal with that, created to directly deal with this issue.
Yeah, the surprise in the billing, to my mind, is that the insurance company doesn't just do their job. I mean, that's the only reason an insurance company exists, is to pay the bill. So that's the only surprise, is when they don't. So in my mind. And I know that that's very, very kind of, you know, for the joke, but it really is shocking what we've done with, you know, we have the McCarran-Ferguson Act, which is, you know, again, we're back into the weeds about things like this. The McCarran-Ferguson Act is something from 1946. That means that you can't sell insurance nationwide. You can only sell it within a state. So you take Delaware.
Why is that?
So the you want the brief history of the McCarran-Ferguson Act?
You know what? I like the Irish version. I like the brief version. Any way you want to share it with us, Dr. Forrestal, I'm happy to hear it.
So back during the war, Second World War, they had frozen wages. So the only way that you can compete for workers was on benefits. So they came along and said, okay, well, we'll pay your healthcare bills if you come work for us. Right? It was one of the benefits they could give you because nobody was getting raises. Everybody was locked in at a certain thing. So you say, okay, well, I can get my healthcare paid for. Great. My family, my healthcare paid for. Great. So this went through the war. And in 46, the labor board came along and said, you know, that looks like a really helpful thing. So you're going to have to do that now forevermore. And they kind of foisted it. The government foisted it on the employers.
Yes.
And the employers said, well, you know, there's like nine guys I'm insuring. So, you know, how do we set rates? Right. Because you need the actuarial tables to be able to set rates for, you know, how much you're going to charge a guy for how long he's going to live when he has, you know, diabetes or he has high blood pressure. Right. You don't have enough. So we have to share information between all the groups in the United States. And at that time, you know, you consider this as, you know, you're in probably the, you know, tens of millions of people in the United States. Right. So I'm not sure what the population would have been in 1946, but you know, right now I do remember one of the things in doing the research was that I think the largest healthcare insurer in the United States right now has as many patients or as many customers as existed in the United States period in 1946.
Yes.
You know, so, but the thing, let's see. So I actually looked at
it.
Yeah, it was 141 million people.
Yep.
All right, in the United States. So anyway, so they said, we have to be able to share the information, you know, and we have to compartmentalize it to individual states. So you can't sell, if you're in Delaware, you can't buy Maryland health insurance. All right, that was protective of the markets. And the thing is, at that time, it made sense, right? There are only three groups that are protected that they can basically collude in setting prices is the railroads, the National Baseball League, and healthcare insurance.
Wow.
All right. So now you bring it forward to, we can communicate very easily across state lines. You know, we're talking, you know, state to state right now. We've both in doing all of this. We're talking to people around the world and, you know, in real time. But the insurance companies realize it's a good thing to have it compartmentalized because then they have greater control. You know, you look at the healthcare insurance companies and the, let's say the healthcare insurance agency up in Rhode Island, it's probably one overworked lawyer in a back room who has to take on this massive insurance company and a bunch of them trying to fight for the consumer rights, and they're going to lose.
You're listening to Ask a Doctor, What Your Doctor Wants You to Know with Dr. Virgie on the Voice America Health and Wellness channel. We'll be back after this short break. I have some exciting news. I wrote a book, What Your Doctor Wants You to Know to Crush Medical Debt, comes out May 19th. But you can head over to Amazon or BarnesandNobles.com and pre-order a copy now. And a book launch wouldn't be complete without some parties, right? Join me next Friday on April 29th for a Crush Medical Debt book celebration happy hour, where I'm giving away Visa gift cards to help you pay for your debt, as well as making a big announcement. See you next Friday at crushmedicaldebt.com.
Your life, your health, your network. You're listening to Voice America Health and Wellness.
You're listening to Ask a Doctor, What Your Doctor Wants You to Know with Dr. Virgie. If you have a question for Dr. Virgie or her guests, you can email Dr. Virgie at dr.virgie@crushmedicaldebt.com. Now back to the show. Here again is Dr. Virgie.
Welcome back to the show. Thank you so much for joining us.
So McCarran-Ferguson basically creates firewalls around every state and doesn't allow them to share. Now, there's been some work on breaking those walls down, but it's just been very, very superficial. They had a vote. I think it was almost 100% in the House of Representatives to get rid of McCarran-Ferguson. And it's 1946 this law has been in existence since. So it's had its day. It needs to go, but the Senate wouldn't pick it up. You know, again, that's sure. Lobbying and the, you know,
exactly.
The advocacy guys and
a
all
lobbying
those
issue.
So if we wanted to imagine creating a nationwide insurance market, you know, where insurers can sell across the state lines, they can sell to anybody. So if you're in Nome, Alaska, you can get great insurance in Maryland, right? For the free market guys, that's what the free market means is open competition. You don't get firewall. You can compete. And their argument is, oh, well, you get the least common denominator. You know, it'll ruin everything. It'll, you know, you get terrible healthcare. It's like, have you looked around? We've got terrible healthcare.
Right.
You know? So, you know, the argument is very, very hollow. And it's a law. It needs to go.
Wow. I just learned something I had never heard about. I heard about the origins of why most Americans get their healthcare through their employers. In the U.S. healthcare system, but I never heard about how it was compartmentalized by states by law.
Yeah,
good to know. Wow.
Like I said, that law right now just needs to go. It had its day. Yeah. So,
what are some other points that you discuss in Crushing Cancer in terms of managing the financial impact of a cancer diagnosis and treatment?
Well, I think I started to allude to the point of checking the bills from day one, hour one, day one. Mm-hmm. So when this is to your work, you know, the first bill that comes in, start there. All right. Once you get a big pile of bills and then having to sort through it and find the errors, it's going to be nearly impossible. So hour one, day one, the first bill that comes through, check it. And if you can get the name of somebody that you can talk to in the billing office, wherever your oncology center is, you know, get your advocate in there. You know, your nurse navigator can help as well, but get the guy in the billing office, say, hey, look, you know, they charged me $9 million for a Tylenol. Is that correct? Mm-hmm. You know, and hopefully they say no, but you never know.
To that point, Dr. Forrestal, one thing I do teach, the number one step that I teach in terms of crushing medical debt is to ask for an accurate bill. So an accurate bill is an itemized bill. An itemized bill is a bill with CPT codes. And I, you know, I can tell you what CPT stands for, but no one uses it. And most people, even who work with it, don't know what the real term stands for. But CPT codes are like barcodes in a store. On every product in a store, you go in, you pick up a product, it has a barcode. You swipe it and it tells you the price of that product. CPT codes work the exact same way in the U.S. medical care system. So every service, every test, every procedure, every office visit has a CPT code. First step, to your point, Dr. Forrestal, is to get an itemized bill. Make a phone call. First step is making a call, a simple call to the billing department of the provider and getting an itemized bill.
Yes, I agree wholeheartedly.
And they'll tell you, unfortunately, there are too many facilities who will say, well, we'll send you a detailed bill and you'll get a bill that doesn't have CPT codes. And it'll just say, it'll say a pharmacy department, or it'll say anesthesia or OR services.
Right. So that I understand, I just want to, because now I'm getting educated here, right? Because ER doctors don't know anything about bills, right? So so it's the itemized versus the detailed.
Right. So, so you're starting with words, right? So they're playing games with words, right? So, what I do I tell people and teach people to get around that, because they'll play the game with the word. If you ask for, I want an itemized bill, I want an accurate itemized bill, and they'll say, sure, we'll send you a detailed bill. And a lot of us who haven't been trained about how this works will fall for it. So it's really important, if you can't remember the difference between itemized bill and detailed bill, then say, I want a bill with CPT codes, common procedural terminology codes. That's why we don't use the whole word. We use CPT codes. Always ask, I got a bill. I'm not sure what this is, but I need a bill with CPT codes. Otherwise, it's not an accurate bill. And by HIPAA, by federal law, you have the right to an itemized bill.
That's CPT really critical codes. To know. That's going in the second edition of my book. That's a fabulous point. That's a fabulous fact to know. That really, really is.
So once you get the CPT codes for each service, then you can say, well, is $9 million appropriate to pay for 2 Tylenol? But if you don't know what you got and what you pay, what they're asking you to pay for, then how can you say, well, I don't know if this is a fair price?
Yeah. Exactly. That is a great thing to know. And like I said, now something I can apply to my own medical bills when they come in. So very, very good. The other thing that we were talking about earlier also is crowdfunding.
And that's
always a topic that it blows my mind. We were talking about this while we were getting ready for the segment. And do you want to land the magic number or should I?
No, sir. You've done the research and I was just floored. I'd seen it, this number last week, as you and I were talking about, but you know what? You're going to have to go for it. I'm just stunned. I can't even talk about it.
Right now in the United States, I'm not sure if they're the top, but they're one of the top payers for medical issues in the United States is GoFundMe. Literally, in the richest industrialized nation in the world, we had 200,000 medical campaigns that generated $650 million in payouts. That makes them one of the largest healthcare payers. Now, they're not insurance, so I get that, but they are one of the largest healthcare payers in the United States. And that just stunned me when I found that out. But there's a really important caveat there. These campaigns, I think we said something like only 14% make their goal. But the big number that you need to know with that is if you get $20,000 or 200 donors, you will be obligated to pay tax on that revenue.
So wait a minute. Really? Yeah.
Yes.
Are you kidding me? I did not know that.
Yep. The fees involved.
Is considered income?
It will be
taxed. You have to report it on. So let me ask you this. Will the GoFundMe at the end of the year, they will send basically a 1099 form to the IRS saying that $20,000 was given to this person?
At $20,001, you have a tax bill.
That's considered income.
It is at that point. So it's, there was a little fogginess about if it's $20,000 and 200 donors, $20,000 or 200 donors. So for safety, I say, if you trigger either one of those, you need to expect a tax bill. So, you give $100, you're going to, you lose 2.9% on the credit card transaction fee. The GoFundMe guys I'm not trying to ding GoFundMe. They waive their fees on any medical stuff. So you got to give them credit for that.
Absolutely.
But the credit card company is not doing that. And then, like I said, if you get $19,000, it's yours less the 2.9%, and nobody bothers the IRS with this. As opposed to, like I said, if you get to $21,000, then you're going to get taxed at whatever that puts you at.
Mm.
So, like I said, it gets a little complicated, but it's a thing to know that it's not just free money. It's
$20,000K. As of now, as of this year, is $20,000, and in our experience, as time goes on, that number rises by the IRS. They increase that number, as the year goes on, years go on. So, yeah, as of now, $20,000. Once you hit that point, anything above $20,000, excuse me, you're going to be responsible for taxes.
Yep. Wow. And like I said, it specifically at the time I wrote the book. So this would be 2019 into 2020, and we're in 2022. So like I said, at that point, those were the numbers on it. And I can, for show notes and like that, I can do a little research, see if that's changed. but that's really important. And there are a few other funding sites. You got to be real careful about the hidden fees. You know, so like I said, it's important to know who's charging you what for, you know, whatever you happen to be fundraising on. So that's one of the scams. You know, we talk a lot about scams in the book, staying away from cancer scams and all like that. Financial yes. scams are a big one, you know, so in any case.
Wow.
Yeah.
That's why I said, you know, you're going to have to talk about it because I'm just done. When I saw this last week in an article, I forgot where I saw it. That's more than what the many for-profit insurance companies, healthcare insurance companies in this country pay out in reimbursements and providers' claims, bills, $650 million.
And counting. That was 2 years ago. So how much have they done?
Those numbers are old. It's more than that by now.
Yep. So it really is a stunning thing. And we really should do better by our people and our patients. You know, like I said, it's if you are sick, if God forbid you get cancer or any of the other stuff that goes on, you know, you shouldn't have to worry about losing your house. The bankruptcies are at 3%. If you get cancer, the bankruptcy rate's 3%. You go, 3% is not terrible until you apply it to the 2 million people every year, you know, and then that doesn't even start to cover the financial toxicity, you know, where you're trying to pay this bill off until the end of time, you know, it can ruin your credit rating. Although there was a recent bit of legislation that the ray of hope that if you have a delinquency on a medical bill, it will not be reported to your credit union. So that's at least something. So that, I don't know who came up with that. I need to do some research on that, but that's at least a bright spot.
Yeah. There was earlier this month, a couple of weeks ago, the changes have been made with the three largest credit reporting agencies, the big three, such that if you paid off any medical debt, it gets wiped off. It doesn't stay on for years if it went to collections. If you end up paying it off, it gets wiped out. But what's also nice is it gives you a little bit more time. Instead of 6 months of a medical bill being delinquent that you may be disputing, it has to be 12 months before it can be reported to the collections, or to credit agencies. There's great things happening, but to your earlier point, it's not enough. You know, we're all in this together, and you know, it's really a problem that most Americans are just one accident or a serious illness away from a lifetime of debt, and it shouldn't be that way. And it doesn't have to be that way. You know, we can do better.
Yes, absolutely.
And with information of the financial resources to deal with cancer treatment and diagnosis and care, you know, Dr. Forrestal, this is good stuff. This is good stuff. I had never heard about 211, and I had never heard about nurse navigators.
Yeah, and they are the gems of the system. They really are.
Thank you so much for talking with us today. I always tell you, I have a blast talking to you. I always have fun talking to you, and I always learn things. And you always get to like the core of stuff, Dr. Forrestal. And thank you so much for being with us today.
Thank you for having me. And I look forward to our future conversations.
Absolutely. For sure. Thanks again. And good stuff. Just good stuff. And much appreciated.
Thank you. Thank you.
Thanks for tuning in to today's show. We hope we have given you some helpful tips to guide you through your medical journey. Until we talk again, have a beautiful week.